Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, April 15th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Triple Threat Lynn Tremblay on a life spent on stage and connecting virtually with an audience.
Just me, who is such a contact-to-people-people person, right? And doing it with this break the lens of the camera and go right through it and just talk to the people out there, you know? Like, that's my goal. And, yeah, anyway, there's no good time, so might as well, you know, go. Let's go. Let's get to it.
Rebecca Turner on writing a comedic vampire radio play entirely in Yiddish.
I have my friends who act as my muses on this one. We were all joking a few summers ago about all the things that we would do, all the things that we would create once we knew Yiddish way better than we did.
Choreographer Estelle Clareton derives inspiration from disaster to challenge the way she views the world.
I'm somebody very optimistic, and for me, humor is part of the medicine I use. and the beauty too, you know, I'm very sensible to beautiful things, even if sometimes I have a tendency to see darkness.
But before we begin, some updates. A week ago tonight, Premier François Legault dialed back the curfew in Montreal and Laval to 8 p.m. from 9:30 p.m. to help combat a recent spike in COVID cases in the cities. But arts venues can remain open with safety protocols and distance seating. So the question has become, at what time should you set a play so that everyone can get home in time for curfew? And I'm happy to report that artists and companies are rising to the challenge. The Siegel Center, for one, is presenting to perform its upcoming play in May with happy hour start times. Every Brilliant Thing begins May 1st, with start times at 1:30, 4, and 5:30, depending on the day. It's about a child trying to help their mother find the joy in the everyday. A co-production with Hudson Village Theatre, Dean Patrick Fleming is directing the Siegel's first live show in over a year. Tickets are $45 by phone only at 514-739-7944. Table d'Hôte Theatre, which mastered live outdoor performances last summer with En Pointe, announced this week that they will present Shorelines in June. Mishka Levine's play about climate change will be performed in a, quote, multi-level panoramic parking garage in the heart of Verdun. And Mainline Theatre has announced an upcoming lottery, possibly for Fringe Summer 2021. Details still to come. One of my favorite venues, the Satosphere on Saint Laurent, is presenting its latest immersive animation show, Under the Dome, at earlier hours. And as you'll hear in this hour to come, the internet is a popular fallback. If you can't open the doors to the public, at least invite yourself into their living room. And another point of interest for the Montreal theater community, Rahul Gandhi has been appointed as Director of Operations at the Quebec Drama Federation. He'll be working alongside Holly Greco. Rahul is a rising young actor in Montreal. You've heard him here on Upstage talking about different projects. He fills the spot left by Patrick Lloyd Brennan, who will now head up ELAN, the English Language Arts Network. A big congratulations to Rahul. And now, on to our show. It's not often that you get the chance to speak with someone who could fill hours and hours with stories about life on stage. Lynn Tremblay is one of those people. She grew up in a small Quebec town, but started dancing at a young age, arriving in Montreal as a teenager and launching her career in French, later moving to Toronto and overseas to star in big musicals like Cats, Cabaret, West Side Story, as well as taking on roles in TV and film. As you will hear, Lynn eventually returned to Montreal, and she's been working on her music. Her latest album, Get Into It, will be launched with a virtual cabaret and live band from her spectacular home in the Plateau next weekend, April 24th, touching on her music as well as life under lockdown. And you can find Lynn on YouTube for a trailer to her show to get a preview of her absolutely gorgeous home. Here is some of that.
Here in my loft in Montreal,
the place where I spend all my days, all my nights.
Oui, on aura un petit pre-show à 19h15 et showtime 19h30, le 24 avril.
Bilingue, bilingual. I will be doing some spoken words, some crazy stories, and tell you a little bit about this place where I live. It's got a lot of history. Yes, it's going to be a riot. I am very looking forward to it. See you then. Ciao. You better dress up for it.
Get ready. Here is my recent conversation with Lynn Tremblay. Welcome to Upstage, Lynn. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello. Well, thank you for inviting me.
So what's it like to be writing music and to be writing stories, monologues at this point in the pandemic?
It puts all our, everything that we've ever talked about, it just makes them really accurate right now, which is, you know, encouragement, self-care, be there for your friends, your family, who are in limbo, right? And having a rough time right now, because lots of my friends are artists and all the work just is gone. And, you know, trying to use a lot of humor and so I guess all these songs are finding new meaning for me, you know, putting them in this context and then writing some extra pieces to thread them, tricoter, like they say in French, you know, to put them all together with this arc of like, we're living in limbo, we're in this together, and we're all black and blue some days, and some days we go, oh, never mind, I'll be fine. But that's what I've been doing, like just trying to put this material and honor the launch of the album, Get To It, which was supposed to be last April. And then when we saw this, pandemic, it just didn't feel right anymore to put it out there. And, but, you know, I don't even know if there is any right time right now to do anything. Everything is so in limbo, right?
To coin the title of your performance, Living in Limbo. Do you have this kind of feeling of, well, might as well do it now? Like, why wait any longer?
Well, yeah, because we just don't know how long we're gonna, even this show has been postponed twice. So to keep adrenaline, you know, adrenaline is my Instagram name, Adrenaline Music. But to keep it up, you know, to keep the energy up and say, okay, am I crazy for doing this? Should I cancel it? Should I do it? No, I gotta do this. It's gotta be done. It's gotta be taped, and we have something there. You know, we have this tool that we can keep sharing, and you know, and I need to get this out. It comes to a point where you go, I've been waiting, I've been patient, let's go, because I don't think this time is going to be the, especially now summer's coming out, you know, people have been probably in front of their screens a lot all winter, and I hope that they're going to be joining us on the 24th to be in front of their screen with us and having this kind of intimate experience from our living room to their living room. And you know, like, I've been trying to think, how is that all gonna work, just me with such a contact to people person, right? And doing it with this, break the lens of the camera and go right through it and just talk to the people out there, you know, like that's my goal. And there's no good time, so might as well, you know, go, let's get to it. That's why the album is called Get To It. It's been my mantra for a couple of years, you know, because this album just took a little bit of time to be born, if I may say, because I was living in Toronto for 30 years. My two girls are still there. Then I moved here, and we started the recording of that album, just before I moved back to Montreal, and then got busy with so many projects, and it got put on the back shelf there for a while. And then one day I said, I gotta do it, gotta get to it, gotta finish what you start. My mom and dad raised me really well.
You use a lot of kind of like mantras. Mm-hmm. Are you someone who needs to kind of talk yourself into doing a lot of things? Do you need to motivate yourself?
Well, finishing the album was because I got so busy with other things. And then, you know, I said, I gotta do that one day. So I came back to it and really focused on it. But you know, I mean, we all have days where, especially when you're a freelance artist, you got to constantly self-motivate yourself, right? You don't have like a job 9 to 5. I mean, sometimes we do have contracts, but these days it's basically me who has to motivate Lynn and go, okay, let's go. You go down and let's go and vocalize and let's go and practice these songs and write some, you know, thoughts and how do you link all this and you know, do some research. And so you really have to self motivate yourself a lot. And some days are not as obvious as others. And, you know, it's okay to take a day off too, right? Like, we have to be kind to ourselves. But yeah, it definitely, it's been this last year, it's been a real, how do you say, like a challenge, but also like a realization that where your weaknesses are and where your strengths are, and, you know, to forgive yourself and to just keep thinking positive. Yeah, I do a lot of talking to myself.
I'm speaking with Montreal-based triple threat Lynn Tremblay, releasing her second album, Get To It, on April 24th. We've been talking about your show as well. Can you just tell me about the logistics? You're actually performing, you're working from home. You're going to be performing on the 24th out of your loft space, which apparently is kind of like a marvel of design.
Well, yeah, this space, it's got so much, such a fabulous history too.
Can you describe it for me? What part of town are you in?
Which I will be talking actually, like I will take, because I feel like this slot and the fact that we're doing it here with one camera, I decided to do it like one long continuous sequence shot, which I've been wanting to do for a long time, like with videos and stuff. So, you know, it's not going to be cut camera one, cut camera two. It's going to be one long shot, which I'm excited about that, because what you see is what we're going to see, what we're going to feel. It's going to be au naturel, acoustic. And this loft has got a beautiful acoustic, actually. And it was an old manufacturer, and then it became actually a manufacturer where they actually build sets from for CBC. Radio Canada, which is not far from here. I'm south of Parc La Fontaine, north of CBC, like, you know, on Rue Baudry. So it's a beautiful area now. We just to walk up the hill and you're in the beautiful park, which I love. And anyway, so this place was actually a place where they build sets. And I used to be a professional dancer, and I did a lot of shows on for Radio Canada, you know, the Bye Bye and all those specials, TV variety specials. So I was just saying that maybe I actually danced on sets that were built in this, my future home, which was, I don't know, you know, I think maybe. And they did costumes here. And I'm fascinated with the history of this building, actually.
That's so cool. There's so much history within that space.
I know. And you know, and there was a lady that lived here too from CBC, and it just doesn't stop. It's a very creative space. Yeah, it's a beautiful vibe.
So you're going to draw inspiration from it, I'm sure. Speaking with Lynn Tremblay, who's presenting or launching her second album on April 24th, you just mentioned your past life as a dancer, which I guess is still kind of your current life as a cabaret performer. And I want to know more about your start in the entertainment business, because you were huffing at first, right? You were in Cats, you were in Cabaret itself, West Side Story. Can you tell me about your start?
Well, you know, I started dancing when I was 9 in the living room at my house in Robertval, Lac Saint-Jean. My dad bought this big old square TVs, you know, they used to be so big and heavy. And we, Saturday night was musical comedy, film night, Hollywood, with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rajah and Sid Cheris. And I just was riveted. I would stand in front of the TV with my pajamas and my big slippers, and I would imitate each one of their moves. And when my parents saw that I loved dancing so much, well, they got me into little ballet classes, you know, that little school in Robertval. And I'm sure we all have these moments in our lives where you just go, oh, something just happened for me. At one Christmas, our ballet teacher, or my teacher at the dance school, said, this Christmas, we're going to do something very unique. Everybody, I'm going to put some Glenn Miller music on, and everybody is going to do, in front of everybody, all the other girls, a little improvisation. And so I was like, oh, I can do that, because my parents had these vinyls of Glenn Miller and band, and I loved all that big that jazz stuff. And so I did my little improv, and I knew I had some moves there that the other girls didn't. My teacher finally paid attention to me, and she said, where did you learn to do this? And I just saw this little girl shy that was always felt like in the corner, you know, but like suddenly I just felt like I had something that I was somebody in that moment. And from then on, I kept doing classes, and we moved to Quebec City, and I was in this dance company and amateur, you know, with on-toe shoes. And my legs, for some reason, could go really develop against my ear, like, and I could just leave it there. And like, I had this thing in my hips that made me do that. So Eddie Toussaint one day from Montreal with the Eddie
choreographer
company, yeah, came to Quebec City, and my teacher then, Madame Molnar, invited him to come and see our little, you know, a performance thing. And he was blown away with my développé being so high and my drama dancing style. He offered me to join his company right there on the spot. And of course, that was like, I had to come home and tell my parents this, because I wanted to be a doctor. I loved the body. I loved how the body worked. And I, you know, that's what I wanted, to be a doctor. But I love dancing, my parents were so gracious. They said, my dad, he said, Lynn, you know what? You can always go back to school one day and be a doctor of sorts, of any kind. You can only dance for so long. So you should go and do this adventure. And so I ended up moving to Montreal at 19 and joined the company. And we went right away on this fabulous tour in Guadeloupe, Haiti, and all South America, you know, and Medellin, you know, Bogota, Quito. And I was like, I never even took a plane at that time in my life. This big Air Canada, huge plane to go on tour with Eddie Toussaint. Yeah, that's the beginning of my career. And after that, then I ended up doing all these TV specials in Montreal. And because I left the company, I wanted more. I wanted to sing too and act. And, you know, just being a dancer was not quite enough for me at that time. So, I ended up joining and being, you know, one of the dancers on all these TV specials, which was really cool. And then I thought, okay, I need more still. I want to learn English. I want to see, you know, more musicals. And so I moved to Toronto and studied heavily dance, like 6 days a week, two, three classes a day. My technique really improved until the day I was asked to audition for Cats. And I was actually, it sounds crazy, but I was actually filming a film here called Night Magic with Carole Laure and Louis Fury and
Leonard Cohen
wrote the music for this film. And so I was actually here in Montreal when they had the dance audition. And it was so funny because I worked so hard in Toronto getting my technique up and, you know, and everything. And when I auditioned here at Place des Arts in the big rehearsal room downstairs, I was with all my friends that I used to dance with. And I could really, really see the progress I had made, you know, because I used to dance with the same peeps. And I was pretty proud. Anyway, again, that Cats thing was the first big show ever in Canada, you know, a musical comedy of that magnitude. And I was offered a job right there on the spot too of Cassandra, the slinky Siamese cat, which was, wow, woohoo, you know? And then just life keeps going. Then I moved to Europe to do cabaret at the Mogador, that was my first big role with singing and a big orchestra. And, you know, life just pushes us, huh? And in directions that you just never expect.
You have so many fantastic experiences that I feel like I could talk to you for hours. But just to wrap up, now you're a cabaret artist and you're telling stories and you're singing songs. You're launching your new album. Can you just maybe tell me a little bit about one of your songs, very quickly, about one of the songs you love the most on this album?
Oh, that's so hard. Because, okay, let's say, One of the songs is one I co-wrote with a friend in Toronto, and it's called Dancing Fool. Talking about, we're going to be in the dance mode here. And I wanted to talk about the way it feels when your body is so free and so no pain, you know, like you're just flying through the air, and what it feels like to be a dancer, you know, unpredictable waves of stomping, clapping, twisting, turning, you know, like, so, and it's a very up a song that, you know, you put it on and you just feel better and you just want to dance and move. And I think it's a perfect song for now because we're all a little bit black and blue, you know? So anyway, that's one of the songs that I just love. And it's an original song, which is nice. And it's my first love, you know, my first big love. Dance.
Lynn Tremblay, it's been such a delight to take some of your time and hear some of your stories. And there's more of that coming with your show later this month. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
That was Lynn Tremblay, performer, presenting her virtual cabaret to kick off her latest album, Get To It. The show is called Living in Limbo, and it will broadcast from her home April 24th at 7:15. Visit sidedooraccess.com for tickets and information. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, Estelle Clareton views the world with an anxious lens. When a natural disaster grabbed headlines years ago, she took that as a starting point to challenge her worldview. Now, a confession for you. I absolutely adore vampire stories, in any form. My current fave is the TV adaptation of What We Do in the Shadows, which places four vampires as roommates in a creepy home in Staten Island, of course, filmed in Toronto. It's a mockumentary series that will bust your gut, but not from horror, from the punchlines. So I had to call up Rebecca Turner when I found out about her latest project. Rebecca is a McGill student with a lifelong passion for the Yiddish language, spoken by Ashkenazim, European Jews, derived from High German and written in the Hebrew language. At one point in the 20th century, it was the third most spoken language in Montreal, behind English and French. And while it's not as commonly spoken today, some Jewish communities still use it here, in Israel and beyond. We have a thriving Yiddish theater scene that still exists here. It's gone back decades. Yiddish even popped up on a language learning app called Duolingo this month. Rebecca's vampire radio play, Blut und Blinzes, will air this Tuesday, April 20th at 7:30 through the Museum of Jewish Montreal, which has been commissioning lots of interesting works in the past year through their microgrant program. In Blut und Blinzes, we follow Chaika Moskovich, a young Montrealer who has recently been turned into a vampire. But no need to download Duolingo, you can follow her story with English subtitles. This is a work in progress, but sure to delight your ears. Rebecca Turner spoke with me earlier this week. Welcome to Upstage, Rebecca. Thank you for taking the time. How are you today?
I am just delightful. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for being here. This hits a lot of boxes for me. We're talking about vampires. It's the Museum of Jewish Montreal, big fan of their work. And we're talking about radio drama. Tell me about the story, the vampires we meet in Blut und Blinzes. And did I say that right? First off, actually.
Yeah. Blut und Blinzes. Yeah. It opens with Chaika Moskovich, who is this vampire in her 20s, very, very, very new to it all. Basically, in the first playlet, in this first episode of the radio play, she has basically been a vampire for maybe, 4 hours, and she's not very good at it. Not very good at it at all. She walks in to her own Shiva, and her sister throws a plate of party sandwiches at her. And she's, it's a life. I mean, well, it's death. I guess that's what she should have expected, and she did not. So, right, it happens. And so the playlet itself really takes place in the rabbi's office, and it's almost like a locked room sort of situation where Chaika and her rabbi really just get down to the details of how one can be both Jewish and a vampire. because blood is not kosher.
Right.
And that's the true problem here.
So this is quite an epic crossover. What inspired you to bring vampire stories, which is like an incredible genre in and of itself, and bring that into Yiddish theater, which of course in its own right is also an incredible body of work?
Oh yes, I'm a little bit biased myself on that because I'm a Yiddishist and I just love Yiddish. And I do these Yiddish programs in the summer, which is how this idea took root. I have my friends who act as my muses on this one. We were all joking a few summers ago about all the things that we would do, all the things that we would create once we knew Yiddish way better than we did. Even now, I think that if I took another year, it would probably turn out a little bit better. But, you know, no time like the present. And so we were all joking about all these things that we would create. And one of the things that came up were vampires. And so this original idea was really this long-running gag about... well, you know, this Orthodox man, he gets turned into a vampire. Again, it happens. And this guy's a little bit of a shlemiel, a shlemazel. And he just ends up waiting outside of bagel shops trying to figure out who's Jewish coming out of them. Because like by the transitive law, if he eats someone who eats kosher, therefore he is eating kosher and life is good. It's all fine. His Jewishness is not at all at risk. Well, his religiosity is not at risk because of this transformation. But then this idea really, really evolved and it became much more focused on this character, Heike. By the way, it's a pun because Heike is life and she's dead. Yeah, and so it just really evolved over the years because this was like 2 years ago. And now we're here.
And you've been working on it ever since. And so
actually,
have you been, are you a fan of like the vampire stories? There's like the Vampire Diaries is like a recent addition to the canon. Twilight, I think, is probably huge for the last couple of years as well. But we go back into Interview with the Vampire. We go back to Dracula. This has been taking root. And also it's been in fables for years, hundreds of years. So do you come to it as a fan?
Oh, completely. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is one of my favorite things of all time. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I never really got into Twilight, but what would happen is that I would pick up other vampire books. And I've always been more on the, I've always enjoyed comedy much more than romance and drama. So whenever I was picking up vampire books, I had to do more with the comedy aspects of it because I personally think vampires are hilarious. I would usually say like, oh, for fans of Twilight. And I would go, ah, no, it's not what I want. I don't want the vampires to fall in love. I would like the vampires just to live in their daily lives. And I want to see that happen. And I've read a lot of books like that, watched, you know, not as many TV shows like that, because usually they're more focused on the romance, the drama of it all. But yeah, that's where definitely I'm coming from.
Where do you see the comedy come in? I'm thinking of... What We Do in the Shadows was a movie shot in New Zealand, inspired a TV show, which I adore. And it's about vampires as roommates. So it's kind of all these weird situations about living with other people, but they suck blood for a living. I mean, to stay alive.
That's actually my best friend's, one of her favorite things. So I've actually never seen it and I should see it, especially since I'm writing this.
You absolutely should. Play.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I think that this is actually... probably making me a little bit less like of a trustworthy source on vampires. but the comedy, a lot of the comedy comes from vampirism coming up against Judaism. So the thing is that I don't think that we could talk about vampirism and Judaism without first noting blood libel. And I went to a Jewish elementary school, Jewish high school, and this came up quite a bit. Not about vampires, but there's blood libel because, again, you know, what else are you going to talk about? And what I think has always been really, really funny to me is that if you really think about it logically, Christian blood, the blood of children, would be like, again, it would be like the worst blood to drink. Like it would be our last choice, which we don't drink blood, but it would be the last choice. Because again, like they don't eat kosher. It'd be basically like, you know, if they ate pork, we'd be eating pork. That would be insane. So really it's just very egotistical and very ignorant. And that's part of the comedy that I bring in, sort of clashing with the history, but also with just sort of this idea of again, like they're just normal people. Vampires are normal people. Like, you know, sometimes they're going to drink someone's blood accidentally, and other times they're going to do it on purpose. Actually, the next episode I have planned is takes place in Bloodsuckers Anonymous, where and then you know the Jewish branch that meets in the synagogue about 3 hours after sunset. There they actually want to change the name from Bloodsuckers Anonymous because Blutzeuger in Yiddish it connotes like capitalism, and so they're all like, no, we don't want to be associated with that. We're socialists here. And Hike is like, oh, okay, yeah,
cool. Leading into that Jewish liberal leanings that have been at the root for decades, I'm speaking with Rebecca Turner, who is the director and playwright of a Yiddish vampire radio play called Blut und Blinzes. You just touched on blood libel, which is this crazy, slander, fake news, you could almost say, from back in the day, that, you know, Jewish people would be used as a weapon, right? That Jewish people are eating children or eating their blood. And it's kind of crazy, but those ideas are still around today, and they're as real as ever, as kind of a lot of racist and anti-Semitic ideas circulate online. Was that kind of part of your thinking as you were digesting all this really strange, dark stuff, but writing for comedy?
I knew that I had to mention it. It was not something that I could just sort of skip over, especially since this is online and this is going to attract, I don't know who's going to see it. And I felt like it was necessary to at least make a few comments about it in the play. So also there's this part, this won't actually translate into English, but if you understand Yiddish, this line at one point, so Chaika's telling her rabbi, oh, I didn't mean to, but basically I drank all this guy's blood and it was awful. And who knows, like, I just kept drinking and drinking. And the rabbi's like, oh my God, is he okay? Did you kill him? And she's like, what? Yeah, no, he's fine. Like, I'm not a Cossack, and he certainly wasn't White Hala, which is this reference to a which is this short story in Yiddish about not actually the blood libel, but about violence against Jews by Cossacks in Russia. I think Russian Empire. Oh, I should remember this, but. But just like, you know, little references like that are thrown in, but again, a little bit comedic, definitely comedically. But again, they're there.
So this is going to be done in Yiddish with English subtitles. It will be online. So anybody who doesn't have a working knowledge beyond, you used the Rich Lemiel earlier, will be able to follow along. Can you touched very briefly at the beginning about your love for this language. Have you been studying that since you were a child?
Yes, actually. I've taken breaks here and there. I started learning Yiddish when I was in elementary school. It was my favorite class. It was always the thing I looked forward to throughout the day. And at one point, they ended up cutting an hour from the week. And I ended up writing a strongly worded letter when I was in grade 3. And I think it really just said, this is a strongly worded letter. I think, and then I got a lot of signatures. So it's been a while. And then the program got canceled when I was in high school, which was a shame. But thankfully at McGill, I got to pick it back up again. And I've been taking these Yiddish summer programs ever since. And they've been such a joy in my life. And have really, I've gotten to experience Judaism from this other side that I haven't got to experience in a while, because just Yiddishkeit, which is this, it just has to do with this sort of cultural Yiddish experience and how we treat each other, and that culture and the comedy and just the feelings, the life experience, all of that. And so I've just gotten to get back into that, and it's been wonderful.
Oh, it's so wonderful to hear. And it's funny because when people wonder, like, is this language still spoken? Is it still alive? I think in more religious communities, they're a bit more closed off to the world, like Hasidic communities. It is the lingua franca. And if people are wondering, but outside that, does it get spoken? It's kind of surviving now through workshops and classes and through the cultural sphere, right?
Yeah, but also there is rather a large, I mean, I think it's large. It's growing every day, especially now with Yiddish Duolingo, which just came out a few days ago. It's a game changer.
Yes.
But there's like a more secular Yiddish community that's been teaching their children Yiddish for a really, really long time. Like these people are Yiddishists. I mean, like some of them have been teaching their children. Since they've learned, maybe grandparents, great grandparents, and it's this whole other culture that has survived and is thriving today. And Yom HaShoah was yesterday, and which is Holocaust Remembrance Day. And usually I sing with a Yiddish choir, and people come up to me afterwards and they say, like, oh, that was so beautiful, that's so wonderful, like, you know, you a young person are singing in Yiddish, but it's such a shame that it's a dead / dying language. And I get to say, well, good news, it's not. It is very much alive. And from this and from a more like Orthodox standpoint, and from a secular Yiddishist standpoint, and really just everywhere in between, it's a really, really, really broad range of people.
So Blut in Blintzes, Blut being blood, Blintzes being a very popular food that you would probably eat at brunch. It's a stuffed crepe or pancake, so good. And this is going to be, this is a read through that you'll be doing on April 20th. A work in progress, and you're also writing different chapters, right? So this is just the beginning of Haika's journey as a vampire.
Yes, it's very exciting. I hope to get at least the first draft of the second episode done in the summer. I have no idea that's going to happen though, because I am a full-time student and I have a couple of other jobs. So it's really a let's wait and see sort of project.
Long-term though, you're hoping this would be a full-on radio play or a stage play?
Even? Oh yeah. In the next few years, I definitely hope to create a series of 3 to 4 episodes of this as a radio play that I would like to put online as sort of like podcast episodes for people to listen to. And it's just really important to me because even though there is so much being done right now in the Yiddish sphere, I don't always see a lot directed at sort of people my own age. The early 20s, maybe like teens, who want to get into Yiddish, but also want to get into like the weird stuff, or not even just weird, but just sort of kooky.
So you're writing in English and then translating your own work into Yiddish?
No, I wrote it all in Yiddish. And then I translated it into English. But just like, you know, just how the mind works, I find that every now and again, I would switch into Anglicisms, and that was always something I had to be very, very aware of.
Can you read a line from the script itself just so we can hear what it sounds like?
So this is a little paragraph. Basically, the rabbi asked her, okay, well, you know, how did this transformation happen? Do you want to talk about, well, you know, how this came about? And Chaika's like, well, it's kind of actually an embarrassing story.
Sarah here. Rebecca is reading from her play in Yiddish. My recording cut out for a few seconds, so we will pick up right here with English translation to follow.
Auf mein Leben und eine Schumme? Nu, hat die Vampir hot gelacht, dass sie hat getrunken mein Blut?
So that translates to new. So I went to this crazy Hanukkah party and I got a little drunk and played dreidel, gambled with a dreidel with a bunch of strangers. Like a kid's game, please, no. These players were totally bloodthirsty. I lost all my geld, my money, my chocolate money. And as a joke, I sort of bet my life and soul on the game. Well, at least the vampire laughed as she drank my blood.
I definitely see the comedy shining through this kind of like shrug. This is what happened. It was a game of chance. Was it hard to find people to be able to provide the voices and to be able to speak Yiddish fluently for this?
It was actually relatively easy. I had such a great turnout for auditions. Really, really, really wonderful people. And I wish that I could have included more, especially since just personally, I always love it when there is this large chorus of people. Sadly, this is not a musical. otherwise I would have my large chorus. And I have such a short time span to put this on in. But I just had such wonderful people who showed up. It was actually very easy to cast.
Well, Rebecca, break a leg, however we might or might not say that in Yiddish. And thank you so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to tuning in.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's just been lovely. And the sun is not set yet, so I can still be here.
That was Rebecca Turner, author of Blut und Blinzes, a radio play. I love her passion for stories and this language. I think this is someone to watch. I don't think we mentioned this, but Rebecca is a member of the Yiddish theater musical community here in Montreal. Rebecca says her next piece might be a sci-fi space drama. In Yiddish, of course, Jews in Space. Her radio drama airs this Tuesday, April 20th at 7:30. It will be in Yiddish, but with English subtitles. The event is free, but you have to register at Eventbrite beforehand. Visit the Museum of Jewish Montreal online at imjm.ca for more info and to find out about their other events. I'm Sarah DeAy. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Have you ever fixated on a disaster in the news? Not sure why, but something immense and tragic touches you from a distance, leaving you with questions about what the victims and survivors experienced. For choreographer Estelle Clareton, that moment came in 2004 when a devastating tsunami ravaged the coast of Thailand. Instead of batting away her thoughts, Estelle leaned into them and the mechanisms of the human mind when faced by an approaching disaster like an oncoming wave. Estelle's new work is called Bouleversement. It will be performed later this month at Agora de la Danse. It follows her style, where dance and theater interact, and touches on her favorite themes, instability and disequilibrium. Estelle spoke to me late last week as she was running exams at the National Circus School, where she is creative director, and we had just found out that the curfew would be moved to 8 p.m. Here is my conversation with Estelle.
Bienvenue, Estelle, to Upstage. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. How are you? We just found out that there's going to be a curfew again for Montreal, and this must be kind of nerve-wracking for you as with a performance coming up. But you're going to still be able to live stream this.
Bye-bye. Yes, it was planned that actually it was not going to be performed in front of an audience because since a few months we were the stage were closed. So it's just recently that we heard that we are going to be able to have an audience in the theater. But now with the situation getting worse, I'm just scared we won't be able to have people in the theater, but at least, yes, it's going to be filmed.
So the piece actually, deals with a lot of themes that people have been dealing with, feeling anxiety, not knowing what's to come, what's in the future, anticipating something bad happening, but it's not tied to the pandemic. You started developing this several years ago, actually, when there was a natural disaster.
Yes, I got really shocked, by the tsunami in Thailand in 2014, imagining all, see how I would have reacted to this appearance of a wave that big. And it really, shocked me, this incident. And I wanted, it came and touched me. I'm a very anxious person, as I said to you before. And I feel that it's something that is still taboo a little bit to show that we want to, when we have anxiety, we have the reflex to hide. And so I had this idea of making a show where I was going to talk about that and how strong it can be, anxiety, and also to make something beautiful out of it. I didn't want to propose a piece was going to be can create anxiety for the audience, not at all. I want to just share what it is to be anxious and make people see the beauty out of it, you know. So that's the idea, and I think it's bizarre that we actually can do the show now during the pandemic and knowing that people are suffering a lot for anxiety, because for me the pandemic is not at all the impulsion of this project. It's more I start working on it with the dancer Esther Rousseau-Morin 6 years ago, so the situation was not as bad as now.
So strangely enough, these ideas you've been wrestling with for years are kind of coming full circle, because people are kind of dealing with those more day to day. Are you hoping mm-hmm. that people will relate more strongly to the thoughts, the ideas that you're putting forward?
Yes, but you know, I would love people who are anxious to come and see the show just so that they can see that they're not alone. And you know, few people went to see some rehearsal already and told me, well, you know, we have a lot of empathy for what the dancer is going through in this piece, and it's not I think it's important to share that and to say it's okay, we can go through, and you're not alone to anticipate the worst, you know. And what can I, it's not didactic, you know, I don't want to give any medicine, you know, about that, but just to say we're not alone, and we are able to go through it, you know.
Yeah, you're not trying to diagnose anybody or give advice.
No.
So I also deal with anxiety. And so what you're talking about is very familiar to me. I think if I was one of those people who had gone to your rehearsals, I'd probably give you the same feedback as the other people. But how can you kind of, how would you put it into terms for someone who hasn't had that kind of daily experience about what it means to be anticipating something bad around the corner?
What I like in this piece, you know, is that we're talking about a subject that is very dark, actually, can be very exhausting, anxiety. But at the same time, you know, I'm somebody very optimistic, and for me, humor is part of the medicine I use, and the beauty too. You know, I'm very sensible to beautiful things, even if sometimes I have a tendency to see darkness. So the show that I propose is, you know, it's at the same time it's carrying a strong purpose, but it's also very beautiful and very light and very funny sometimes.
Estella, I wanted to ask you about how you're taking care of your audience in this performance. I've been to dance pieces. I think of a Dave St. Pierre show I went to where I was very stressed out in the audience by everything going out on stage. Mm-hmm. There's like a dog barking and there's a woman getting naked. There's a lot going on. I'm sure a lot of people have had that experience where there's tension building very slowly. Mm-hmm. This is kind of what you're exploring, this anxiety, not sure what's coming ahead. You have an idea of what's in front of you, like the tsunami that you've been describing. Mm-hmm. But yet you don't want the audience to feel that tension. You still want a level of comfort there. Can you, is that accurate? Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, I'm not at all interested in having the audience stress or go through anxiety during the show. Not at all. That's not what my point of view is. I'm more interested in sharing or putting the audience in the place of a witness of something that's happening, but which is in which is not involved. I mean, I don't want him to feel the anxiety the interpret is having on stage. She goes through a lot, you know, but mm-hmm. but there's a distance between what she's going through and between and what the audience is going through. we talked a lot about the idea of being more like in a museum kind of experiment, you know, where you can, you are in the museum, you look at a tableau, a piece, and it's beautiful, tormented, with a lot of colors and that, but you're not in the tableau, you know, you're outside and you're looking and you are witnessing something. That's why we made some choose, for example, with the music. It's not stressful music. There's a lot of beauty just in Esther herself, but also in the choreography, the way she moves. She's a virtuose, you know, she's such a beautiful dancer. So we use all our tools to make the audience witness something dramatic, but he's not included in the drama.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he's taken by it. Like, you know, I'm interested in the fact that maybe he feels compassion, but I don't want him to have anxiety. No, I'm not interested in that. It's not the purpose of that piece.
Well, I thank you for that as an audience member. It's a bit easier to appreciate the beauty of it without kind of being in those shoes. I'm speaking with Estelle Clareton, who is the choreographer of Bouleversement, coming to Agora de la Danse on April 28th. Estelle, I'm wondering for you as a choreographer, knowing very likely that the audience will be taking this in from home and watching Esther's performance, you know, maybe on a couch or in bed. Do you ever wonder about how, on the receiving end, how the experience is changing because people aren't, you know, in a theater with the performer? Do you worry about that?
I worry that, no, I'm not worried because we're going to do a very beautiful captation and you know, people who are interested in seeing the show anyway, you know, like are going to be, you know, I think happy with the proposition. But it's for sure for me, the piece is not made for the camera. The piece is made to be seen live, you know? So, I mean, the experience the audience is going to have is not exactly what I want them to have, because I thought about a public who was going to be here with Esther, you know? So, it's, you know, recently I've seen the piece that, I have a blank, but the choreographer who worked with the Opéra de Paris recently from Vancouver. I'm sorry. Anyway, I watched a piece, you know, was made for the live and was presented on virtually, and I had a good experience. But I would have preferred to be in the theater because it was made for the. the presence live of the audience, you know. So for me, it's not replacing at all the experience that I wish people could have in the theater. You know?
Yeah. When we were speaking earlier, you were telling me about how after you've finished a piece, and I know these can take years to conceive an idea and work on it, develop it, to get to the other side, and that it helps you process some of the things that you're working through. And I think that applies to Bouleversement, this current piece. Have you come to your realization of what you were kind of thinking about when you first started working on this 6 years ago?
Yes, and I think that it took me 6 years of gestation. I don't know how you say that in English.
Gestation, yeah.
Gestation, yeah, because, you know, we started to work with Esther 6 years ago in the studio of Conseil des Arts de Montréal in Montreal, just the two of us. And And it's just recently in February that actually I finished the piece. And maybe I wasn't able to finish it before, you know, I wouldn't have been able. So it was long, the process. It's not always that long for a piece, you know, but this one maybe needed some time. I feel like we're super ready, you know, we're ready to perform and to offer that to the audience. But 6 years was good for this one. It's a big one for me. It's very intimate also work, you know, and it's also, it's funny because it's, the term, you know, bouleversement, do you say that in English, bouleversement? No.
That doesn't translate directly, but I think you kind of say kind of like a big event or something, an upheaval.
Yeah, a pivot point, like a moment that everything changed. It's a bouleversement. And so at the same time, you know, it's a work that I couldn't have done without Esther, this dancer you're going to see on stage, because she's really a partner for me, a creative and an artistic partner since 13 years now. Mm-hmm. And and at the same time, I have a whole new team of conceptors, like the composer is, it's the first time I'm going to be working with them, the scenographer, the light designer, and the technical team also is new. So it's also an artistic important moment for me of being challenged by a team that is very strong and very very intelligent, and you know, every moment we have where we think about the piece is very interesting and exigent. So I really appreciate.
Is the seed planted for your next piece, which might take another few years to gestate?
I don't have a new piece in mind. I think this one is a big one for me. It's a maybe a turning point, or maybe the end of a cycle, or but it's I need to finish it and to digest it.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Then and then maybe something new can
it's true. You do have this, it's not quite, the journey isn't finished just yet for bouleversement.
No.
Thank you so much, Estelle, for taking the time. It's much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
That was Estelle Clareton, choreographer of Bouleversement. Her show will be presented by dancer Esther Rousseau-Morin to limited audiences on April 28th to 30th and May 1st, and online May 7th to the 14th. Estelle and her team will present a short look behind the scenes on April 21st at 12:15 via the Agora de la Danse Facebook page. For tickets and more info, call 514-525-1500 or visit agoradanse.com. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Triple Threat. Lynn Tremblay presents her cabaret Living in Limbo April 24th. Visit SideDoorAccess.com. Rebecca Turner, writer of Blut und Blinzes this coming Tuesday. And choreographer Estelle Clareton presenting Bouleversement at Agora de la Danse later this month. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under Archives. A big thank you to Mariam at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and ckut.ca. Until next time, stay home and stay safe.
Las vacunas COVID-19 y usted.
¿Cómo sé que las vacunas COVID-19 son seguras?
Cuando algo es nuevo, es normal tener preguntas. Queremos que sepa que Health Canada solamente autoriza vacunas que son seguras, efectivas y de la más alta calidad. Canadá es reconocido a nivel mundial por sus altos estándares y su riguroso proceso de revisión de vacunas. Obtenga más información sobre las vacunas COVID-19 en canada.ca/covidvaccine. Un mensaje del gobierno de Canadá.
Teen vaccines ate tusi.
Mainu kime pata lage ke COVID-19 vaccines surakhit han?
Jad koi cheez navi hove ta ajehe prashn karne aam han. Asi tuhanu jankari dena chahunde ha ki Health Canada sirf una vaccines nu hi pravanki dindi hai jehdiyan ki surakhit, prabhavshali ate uttam quality diyan hon. Duniya bhar vich Canada apne ucche miyara ate sakht vaccine review prakriya layi janiya janda hai. COVID-19 vaccines bare vadheri jankari layi canada.ca/covidvaccine te jao. Canada sarkar vallon sandesh.
L'alerte de votre région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de famille dans les résidences et cours privées sont interdits et les déplacements vers d'autres régions sont à éviter. De plus, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 21h30 et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les mesures en place pour lutter contre la COVID-19. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's spoken word coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's collective management committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Welcome to the April 15th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight from Alternative Radio, we have a debate entitled Anti-Zionism is Anti-Semitism. It was recorded at the Emanuel Centre in London in the UK